The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. This is an unusual broadcast because today I'm speaking to you from Canada. I'm here in Western Canada for several days as part of a speaking tour to address meetings in Edmonton, Vancouver, and Victoria as the guest of Paul Fromm and the Canadian Association for Free Speech. Earlier today, I finished the last of the three meetings and here in Victoria, and that's where I'm doing this recording. Paul Fromm and I have known each other for quite a few years and have worked together on a number of projects in a number of different ways over the years. We first met in 1988 when I was in Toronto to testify for 5 days as an expert witness in the Great Holocaust Trial, the second Holocaust trial of Ernst Zindel in Toronto. Now, by way of background, though, these two trials, 1985 and 1988, generated immense interest and publicity across Canada because Ernst Zindel was tried and put on trial for publishing a booklet entitled Did 6 Million Really Die? He was tried under the so-called false news law. The trial dragged on in these two major trials and ultimately went to the Supreme Court of Canada, which found that the law under which he had been convicted was unconstitutional. This ended up being, therefore, a tremendous victory for freedom of speech and for rights in Canada, that Ernst Zindel really deserves gratitude from people across the country for winning this major victory. But that didn't keep him ultimately from being kicked out of the country and declared a persona non grata in the country in a follow-up matter. But in fact, Ernst Zindel did more for the rights and the freedoms of Canadians than many of those who claim to be champions and defenders of freedom of speech in Canada, similar to the situation in the United States, where many of those who claim to be in favor of freedom and rights and so forth are actually more involved in trying to restrict people's rights. Over the years, in addition to that, I've spoken at and testified at two hearings of the Human Rights Commission in Canada, because after the Ernst Zindel victory in the so-called false news case, the major Zionist organizations, which were very interested in silencing Zindel, then brought legal action against him on the basis that the booklet that had been declared legal in printed form should be declared illegal because it was posted on the so-called Zindel website that was maintained in the United States. So the case dragged on then before hearings of the so-called Human Rights Commission, in which Paul Fromm played a major role, and as I mentioned, in which I testified. But over the years, Paul Fromm has invited me and hosted me to address meetings of the Canadian Association for Free Speech, not only in Ontario province, that is in Toronto and area around there, but also in Western Canada and British Columbia. And in addition to that, Paul Fromm has spoken at a number of IHR events over the years, including last December, he addressed an IHR meeting at our offices in Orange County, Southern California. Now, this speaking tour of Canada started off on a very unusual note when I arrived at the Vancouver airport from Los Angeles and was questioned by a Canadian border official who asked me why I was coming to the country. And I sort of explained what I was doing, and he asked me if I was here on business. And I said no, because I'm not selling anything, I'm not getting paid for what I'm doing here. And I explained that I was meeting with some people, but I said that it wasn't a business trip. Well, he asked me further questions and decided that it really is a business trip, and then began looking through papers in my bag. He quickly found a magazine near the top that I had put, along with a lot of other things, to read on the flight coming up, which had a big marijuana symbol on the front cover, and began questioning me about whether I was carrying marijuana or not. Then he found another flyer or booklet that I had brought along, talking about Islam and its relationship to terrorism, and that excited his interest even more. Then he also found a letter which I had received not long ago from Ernst Zundel. Well, he knew who Ernst Zundel was, and that excited his interest even more. And at that point, he took out all the papers from my bag and had me sit down and disappeared for several hours while he did a lot of research and checking on just who I was and why I was in Canada. Well, after several hours, he called me in for more questioning, and in the meantime had done a lot of checking up on me and what I do and what Paul Fromm does. And he had printed out a profile about me from the website of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, which of course was very misleading and a smear against me, of course. In fact, the description about me that appears on the website of the Anti-Defamation League contains a quotation attributed to me that's completely untrue. In fact, it's somebody else. But the Anti-Defamation League doesn't care really about whether it's true or not, and has enough believability to still be effective. But the upshot of the detention was in a sense a good one, because the authorities finally decided that I could come to Canada, and it was there was no objection to me addressing these meetings in Western Canada. And that's a good thing, although it caused some trouble for Paul Fromm, who was expecting me to arrive at the airport in Edmonton, Canada, and I didn't show up when I was scheduled to. And I had no way of contacting him to let him know that I had been detained by the customs officials. Well, the result of all of that was confusion and concern that I had been detained, or I wasn't allowed into Canada at all, or I had missed the flights, or something like that. Well, I got a later flight to Edmonton, and in fact was able to address the meeting on time, so ultimately it didn't really cause all that much problem, and I was able to carry on with the rest of the speaking tour without any great difficulty. Now, the struggle for freedom of speech in Canada is one that doesn't get enough attention, I think, in the American media, but it's an important one because it has importance and implications for the United States and also for Europe. The laws on freedom of speech are more restrictive than they are generally in the United States because of the legacy of in the United States of freedom of speech, and especially the First Amendment to the Constitution. Freedom of speech is pretty respected in the United States in a way that it is not so much in Canada. So the struggle for freedom of speech has been a more difficult and one over the years than it has been even in the United States. Not only in the case of Ernst Zundel, but more recently on the question of internet freedom of speech. During the time that I was in Edmonton, I met with a person who is currently targeted by the Human Rights Commission, a man named Terry Tremaine, who's under investigation for items that he had written and posted on a website in the United States that are considered offensive. But another case that's gotten quite a lot of attention in Canada involves Mark Lemire for an item that he had posted some years ago on the so-called Freedom site that he maintained. Well, this case has attracted a lot of attention here in Canada, and ultimately the Human Rights Commission decided that the material he had posted was really not unconstitutional, that it was not in violation of the Constitution. And just before I left on this tour of Canada, Mark Lemire sent out to a lot of people, including me, the news that very likely the section of the Canadian law restricting freedom of speech on the Internet very likely will be overturned. Now, the battle is still going on, but the publicity focused on this section of the Canadian law, highlighted by the Mark Lemire case and by some other cases, has generated such feeling against the law altogether and the abuses that some people have carried out in an effort to try to trap so-called hate speech people, that very likely the law will be overturned. Now, with me here is Paul Fromm, and I'm going to have him explain a little bit more about the Mark Lemire case, a case that he's been very much involved in from the very beginning and which has been going on for quite a few years. So, Paul, tell people a little bit about the Lemire case and what this means and what the background of it and what it means especially for everyone in North America.
I'd be glad to, Mark. Before I do that, though, there are a couple of free speech issues you brought up. First of all, you mentioned Ernst Zundel, and as you say, Canadians owe him a debt of gratitude for at great expense, and in a battle that saw him denied his rights to freedom of speech for 9 years, Ernst Zundel overturned a very archaic Canadian law that was never meant to be used to suppress political opinion or historical opinion. Ernst Zundel was charged in 1983 under a very obscure section of the Canadian Criminal Code called the False News Law. The government did not believe it had enough evidence to convict him under the so-called hate law, which we'll probably talk about later. But the False News Law went way back to the middle of the last century, and actually the 19th century, and it referred to or tried to deal with a situation where people would deliberately misstate financial news. In those days, for instance, if you could, if you would tell farmers that there was a glut of wheat on the market in England, you could get them perhaps to sell their crop below price, at fire sale prices. It was meant to do that, to control that. So it was meant to control the deliberately lying about a fact, for personal gain. So what they tried to contort this to mean was Ernst Zundel, he was charged actually with publishing a book, Did 6 Million Really Die, which offers some evidence that the Hollywood version of World War II, namely that the Nazis killed 6 million Jews mostly by gas chambers and so on, that was incorrect, and the true figure was something very considerably lower than 6 million. So what the Crown was arguing was that this was false news. Well, it was a historical opinion that Ernst Zundel was offering. When he was charged, his bail conditions insisted that he was not to to talk about or publish about the so-called Holocaust. So from 1983 until the case finally ended before the Supreme Court in 1992, where the Supreme Court tossed the law out as unconstitutional, he was gagged. Now, the maximum he could have been jailed under the false news law was 2 years. So although he won, and this was after two trials, several appeals, an appeal that went all the way to the Supreme Court, in a sense, the enemies of free speech succeeded in gagging him for 9 years. And that is the evil. That's one of the many aspects of evil of anti-free speech laws. They don't necessarily even have to convict you to create a great deal of misery in your life. Mark, I don't accept your rather hopeful interpretation of what happened to you. Yes, you were allowed into the country. And yes, despite the fact that you were trashed, and much of what was said by B'nai B'rith was false or wild exaggerations, you conclude, well, in the end, you were allowed in. Yes, you were. But this is a form of low-level harassment. You have unpopular opinions. The government of Canada would probably rather that you not be here to express those opinions. They don't probably, if push came to shove, really have the power, unless you don't have a criminal record, you're not advocating violence. They really don't have the power to keep you out. But this was a way of hassling you. It meant that very potentially you might have missed that meeting. They knew, I'm sure they knew, that almost all the flights were almost totally full. In fact, they were overbooked. There was a very good chance Air Canada might not have been able to get you to Edmonton. This is sort of low-level harassment. I ran into the same thing when I went to Australia. I entered Australia twice on the same visa. I went to Australia from Canada in 2010. Entered Australia, left Australia to go to New Zealand, came back from New Zealand, and was in Australia again. I was there to give a couple of talks. The Australian authorities, after screwing me around, gave me a visa. They gave me a visa, though, the day after the speech, the date on which I was supposed to speak in Australia. So what my host did was to arrange several speaking engagements several months later. So I did get to go to Australia, so I have a visa from them, I have their approval. I enter the country, and I'm held up for about 2 hours. A lot of silly questions. They knew I was coming. But what this is just a way to say, we want to shake you up a little bit. We want to make your life a little difficult. I went to New Zealand. I came back for a couple of days. I came back to Australia. Just the same thing all over again. Same silly questions. So I don't take quite the rosy view that you do. This is low-level harassment. They don't like you. They don't like me. I don't think it was quite as innocent as you might have thought. But yes, in the end, you got in and you did this tour, and it's been really good. As to Mark Lemire, Mark Lemire is perhaps right now the flagship case in free speech in Canada. The Canadian Association for Free Expression, have been involved in a battle that actually now goes back over 15 years, having to do with free speech on the Internet. The enemies of freedom, of course, probably cottoned onto it even before a lot of dissidents and other people, just how valuable the Internet is and how wild and free it is. Forces I would consider Zionist or politically correct had pretty much got a stranglehold on the print media and the electronic media. I say pretty much. There's the odd, relatively right-of-center populist columnists that would get the odd good view in, the odd talk show host. But essentially, more by the early 1990s, more and more issues were just simply undiscussable. you could not get, nor can you today, get a realistic discussion of the replacement by policy of the European founding settler people of Canada and the United States. We will be a minority by 2050 in Canada, by 2041 or earlier in the United States. And this is catastrophic. If you're a member of the European majority, we are being replaced by policy. We ought to be able to at least discuss this. You can't. Well, anyway, by the early 90s, the forces of political correctness had essentially got a stranglehold on most of the media. Along comes the internet, and that stranglehold becomes a lot less important. And as the internet becomes more sophisticated, well, right now, you know, we're on the internet with radio. We could actually, if we had a YouTube facilities, people could see our ugly mugs. We could do a video, and so on. The ability for people to be their own publishers, their own producers, their own radio people is amazing, and that means the strength of the media monopoly has weakened, and of course there are folks who didn't like that. So there have been efforts to restrict the media, the internet in Canada. One of the means of that was Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. That goes back to about 1978, and in those rather innocent old days, what they were trying to restrict were telephone answering machines. Now, some Canadian dissidents and populists and so on adopted the tactics of that were, I believe, pioneered in the United States by the John Birch Society with the old Let Freedom Ring approach, where they would tape record a little 3 or 4 minute political message and advertise the telephone number, and people would call in and get these messages, which were changed from time to time. There were several dissident telephone messages in the late 70s, and the government decided to tag on like a misshapen tail to the Canadian Human Rights Act in 1978, Section 13. Section 13 says that it's a discriminatory practice to communicate, in those days telephonically, today over the internet, a material that is likely to expose to hatred or contempt any of a list of privileged groups, which would be race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, and a couple of other odds and sods. As the number of cases were heard, there was a strange sort of jurisprudence that developed. Truth was no defense, intent was no defense, and the threshold was very low. The words say exposed to hatred or contempt. Well, no, the government never had to prove that anybody was ever moved by what was said. Being a communicator, and actually having studied under Marshall McLuhan, I know communication is a lot more sophisticated than simply you say something. Well, that doesn't mean people believe you. In fact, you may say one thing, but because of the extravagance of your language or because of your personality or reputation, people might be convinced of exactly the opposite. So the approach of the Human Rights Commission and tribunals is a very simple-minded, almost childish one. Because it is said, you know, results happen. Not so. The government does not have to prove anybody ever had their opinions changed by what was said. Furthermore, exposing to hatred or contempt. Well, I think hatred is hard enough to prove, but what's contempt? Contempt, really, is any negative comment about a group where if the comment's believed, one might think slightly less of them. I often use the example because it's not included under the Human Rights Act, but I think it's pretty understandable. Governments in both Canada and the United States have vilified smokers for decades. with advertising that shows wrinkled skin and yellow teeth and discolored hands, and we're told that pictures of diseased lungs and organs, and we're told smokers have bad breath and all the rest of it. Assuming you believe these assertions, you would be led to have probably a lower view of smokers. You would think, they lack self-control, or what they're doing is foolish, or whatever. Yeah, I'm sure you wouldn't hate them, but that's all. I mean, if smokers were a privileged group, you'd be in trouble. So it essentially makes privileged groups, but sexual orientation, so we're talking basically homosexuals, Zionists, to a lesser extent, blacks. It makes it very difficult to criticize them.
Thank you, Paul. We're going to take a break here and resume in a few minutes with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
The streets of Spanish cities become a battlefield as tens of thousands of school children and students have been protesting against the education cuts. The demonstrations turned violent earlier this week in the city of Valencia, where 17 people were injured in what's been called a heavy-handed repression of the rally. 5 days of protest have been sparked by the latest budget cuts implemented to meet tough EU deficit targets. RT Sarah Firth has more from the Spanish capital.
Scenes of austerity anger on the streets of Spain. In Valencia, clashes broke out between riot police and university students and young protesters as they demonstrated against education budget cuts, which they claim have left many classrooms without even basic heating. Now, scenes of riot police chasing, dragging and hitting the protesters and claims of arrests being made in some cases involving minors have sparked widespread criticism. Here in Madrid, a smaller group of protesters turned out by the Education Ministry in support of the protesters in Valencia. But this is just part of the wider demonstrations we've seen taking place across the country in recent days. Now, the new Conservative government's been in power just a few months, but was faced with its first massive union protests over the weekend. Now, the government had introduced tough measures that they say were necessary to bolster Spain's economy, but have hit the public sector hard, including health and education. Now, Spain's the fourth largest Eurozone member, but has the highest youth unemployment rate. Shockingly, more than 49% of Spain's youth are now unemployed. That's 16 to 24 age group finding it extremely hard to get jobs. And the adults not faring much better, 22% unemployment amongst the adults in Spain. People here in the country in increasingly desperate situations are left asking really just how much worse the situation can get.
Greece is also bracing itself for a new round of protests following approval of its bailout deal. The country remains in the eye of Europe's financial storm as the agreement leaves Athens with years of pain ahead. A second cash injection of 130 billion euros has been agreed in exchange for drastic measures and sensitive concessions. One of them is to allow permanent monitors into Athens to control how the country fulfills the demands of its creditors. Dr. Shahrazade Rehman from the EU Research Center thinks Greece won't be able to escape default even with the rescue cash.
There's no question that the Greeks are going to end up defaulting at some way down the road. The problem is the Europeans, the rest of the Eurozone, is not quite ready for a disorderly default right now. And so another 130 billion is being poured into that country so that there isn't a disorderly default, so it doesn't spill over.
We'll be right back.
let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. I'm here with Paul Fromm in Victoria, Canada, during a speaking tour I've been doing for several days, and we're talking about the battle for free speech in Canada. Paul Fromm, who's been involved in this struggle for many years, has been talking about the case of Mark Lemire. I'm turning the microphone back over to him to provide an update on this very important case.
Okay, before our break, I was giving a bit of a background of the Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act, which since 2001 has applied to the Internet, because that is the main target of the enemies of free speech in Canada. So one of the people charged by a man named Richard Warman, who's an Ottawa lawyer and a great opponent of free speech on the Internet. He says that his approach is maximum disruption, shutting down the neo-Nazis. Now, you mustn't imagine we're talking about people goose-stepping. Anybody to the right of Ronald Reagan would be considered a neo-Nazi, I guess, by any means necessary. And one of the approaches he's taken were charges under Section 13. He made a number of them in the first half of the first decade of the 21st century, and we lost every single case. But that's not surprising, because truth is no defense, intent's no defense. Mark Lemire was a well-known webmaster. He has a website called the Freedom Site, which hosted a number of different groups. And so in 2005, where Richard Warman filed a Section 13 charge against him, and Mark spent the better part of 7 years fighting that. Mark fought it on what's called the merits, but he also challenged the law. He challenged the constitutionality of Section 13, saying that it was contrary to Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which guarantees free speech and free expression, and freedom of the press, etc. That case meandered before a tribunal up until the 2nd of September 2009, and Mark became the first person to ever win. The tribunal chairman had been given a tremendous amount of evidence of dirty tricks played by the Human Rights Commission, where they or people like Richard Warman, who were complainants, would adopt false identities, trying to pretend to be anti-homosexuals or Nazis or whatever, to entrap people. And there was a lot more to it. But one of the essential things that we did was we felt that we had to challenge the basis of the law. Unlike in the United States, where your First Amendment refers to your rights as a human being, and one of your rights as a human being is freedom of speech, no qualifications. In Canada, we have a Napoleonic Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which says, yes, well, the state gives you certain rights. You don't have rights by being nature being a human being. The state sort of doles you out little bits and pieces of rights, but it can take it away. Now, to kind of make a long story short, what the courts have decided was, if the government has a good goal in mind, and it restricts your rights in order to achieve that goal, and provided it doesn't go too far, that's acceptable. What the Supreme Court bought when Section 13.1, when it just referred to telephone answering machines, what they accepted in 1990, when Doug Christie took an appeal to them, was that hate propaganda has a very bad effect on minorities, and makes them afraid, it makes them doubt themselves, not want to be themselves, hate themselves, and withdraw from participating in society, and maybe at the extreme end hit the booze and the pills. All of that was based on a psychological report prepared way back in 1965 by a Jewish psychologist at the University of Toronto named Frederick Kaufman. We felt that was not very good science. And we brought forth an expert witness by the name of Dr. Michael Persinger, who's a professor of neuropsychology at the University of Laurentian University. He testified that was just a false account. I mean, that is just basically junk science that confronted with material critical of them, or if you want to call it hate propaganda or whatever, a group will take one of two reactions. It'll either brush it off as being absurd or laughable or crazy, or it will get angry and say, well, okay, we're angry, we want to refute this, we want to say something, we want to counter it, we want to put out a press statement or hold a protest or write a letter or talk to our member of parliament or whatever. But neither reaction is bad, but especially the latter one is healthy. That's just good public debate. What we have been trying to do is to undermine the basis for this law. Mark Lemire won at the tribunal level. The government appealed. That appeal was heard on the 13th of December last year. For the first time ever in a case like this, we had more interveners, or in American terms, amici curiae, on our side, on the freedom side, than on the other side. We think we've got the wind in our sails on this one, and that we will win that appeal. In the meantime, there's been a piece of legislation that's working its way through our parliament. It's called Bill C-304, and it would abolish Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. It just has received second reading, which is approval in principle. It goes to committee, and with the Conservative majority, will likely be reported back to the House of Commons, and third reading is a formality. So we are... An informed MP told me we're probably going to see the law repealed by this summer. Well, that's looking at it, hopefully, but this is a big battle, and that's not the only way they can get you, but at least that's the Lemire case.
Yeah, thank you very much, Paul. Yeah, I think it's important, as you mentioned earlier, not to be naively hopeful or optimistic when it's not warranted about all of this, and quite agree with this. And this was brought home to me very, very forcefully when I was testifying in these Human Rights Commission's hearings in Toronto during the Zundo matter. I was just very, very struck, very, very impressed, as it were, by the relentless determination of the major Jewish organizations in Canada, the Canadian B'nai B'rith organization, which is the counterpart of the ADL in Canada, the Canadian Jewish Congress, and so forth, to do everything in their power to silence Aaron Zundel and anybody else they regarded as any kind of dangerous adversary to their interests and their agenda. And this came out just really strongly for me during this Human Rights Tribunal, and the absurdity of trying to silence or punish Aaron Zundel for a booklet that had already been declared legal in hard copy printed form, but which they were trying to get him on the basis that it was available on an internet website in the United States. And certainly the organizations like the ADL in the United States and so forth, however it might be more difficult for them because of the internet, are still doing everything possible in their power. One campaign that we've devoted some time and effort to in the United States is against web censorship. And this is a campaign that I think deserves a lot more attention and effort than I've been able to give to it, and a lot more publicity than it's gotten in the United States, because a lot of big companies offer so-called web filtering services in the United States to block access to pornography and other sites that they don't want employees and other people looking at. Well, they've bent to the will of groups like the Simon Wiesenthal Center and the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, and have included sites like the IHR and so forth, which they call hate sites, blocking them from access through these so-called web filtering services. Now, we've contacted these web filtering companies, these web filter service companies, to protest against this and to strongly dispute the idea that a website like the IHR and many others are promoting so-called hate. And this is a smear, it's an absurdity. In fact, oftentimes the IHR website will be blocked on one of these web filtering services on the basis that it promotes hate/violence. Well, that's even more absurd. But the real irony of all of this is that and I think the hypocrisy of it all of it, is that groups like the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith and the Simon Wiesenthal are staunch and relentless defenders of a country, Israel, that is routinely, institutionally discriminating against people on the basis of their ancestry, both in their internal laws and their immigration laws, which uphold, as part of their very nature, discrimination and a second-class status for people. And yet, the idea that anybody should block the website of the Simon Wiesenthal Center or the Anti-Defamation League is one that never occurs to most people. In fact, I'm not particularly in favor of blocking access to those sites, but if anyone's promoting hate, and even more in the case of the Anti-Defamation League and the Simon Wiesenthal Center, they're promoting war. They're promoting aggressive action and violations of international law and so forth, but this double standard is still in place. But here, going back to Canada, this tremendous battle for against so-called politically incorrect ideas and offensive ideas is continues here, and I think that as optimistic as I try to be from time to time, it's very important, as you say, not to rest on our laurels. Just the other day in Canada, there was a news item that involved the censorship of a song by Edith Piaf, a famous French singer, in a school in Montreal, which had cut out a final stanza or verse from her song that made a reference to God. And this is, again, part of a relentless campaign to aimed against the cultural culture and the legacy and the heritage of the majority population of Canada. And the efforts by people to censor this song by Edith Piaf received some attention in the Canadian press, and hopefully it will enrage still more people to try to fight against this entire political correctness campaign. And, of course, it continues not only in Canada and in the United States, but also in Europe as well. There was just recently in France a tremendous discussion and battle over a law approved by the French Parliament making it illegal to deny or downplay the genocide of Armenians. And, of course, if you followed this case, the Turkish government immediately complained about this and pledged that there would be repercussions against France for approving this law. But that's the logic of the stupidity and the absurdity when governments become involved in trying to decide what version of history is the correct one or what version of history is the incorrect one. And, high point, or the low point, if you will, of these efforts by governments to dictate history are the so-called Holocaust denial laws that exist in Germany and Switzerland and Netherlands and a number of other countries, whereby people have actually been forced into exile, been imprisoned, and fined for disputing the so-called official, politically correct version of history with regard to that. But this is a very dangerous thing, of course, but as time goes on, it's more and more difficult, I think, to uphold these in the way that used to be possible because, as you mentioned earlier, the tremendous impact that the Internet has had. Material that the Canadian government would like to keep people in Canada from seeing, it's very difficult to uphold that in any conscientious way because people in Canada can access sites in the United States and other countries where all material that the Canadian government and Jewish organizations here would like to ban is readily available all over the place. In fact, one of the most gratifying trends that I have seen over the last 10, 15, 20 years is the awareness on the level of many younger people about a lot of these issues, which was much more difficult to gain when I was younger, because material that's now readily available on websites was very difficult to access when we were younger. You had to write away for booklets and items and books published by obscure publishing houses in obscure places, and now a great deal of information is available on the internet that used to be just very, very hard to get. And one of the results of that is many, many more, especially younger people, sort of understand the whole picture, have an awareness of the lay of the land and what's going on in not only in the world we live in today, but also about history in a way that was not true 10 and 20 years ago. So that the control of the mass media, which used to be funneled through just a few special outlets, the three major television networks when I was a boy, the major wire services, and New York Times, the Washington Post, now that kind of gatekeeping, that kind of control of the media is not the same as it used to be. One example of that is the appearance over the last 10 years, the last 5 years, of RT television, Russia Today, which is run by the Russian government, and Al Jazeera, which is offers a perspective on the Middle East that is oftentimes a very refreshing counterpart or difference than what we're used to seeing on the major American television network. So that RT, Al Jazeera, and of course many other networks and many other outlets offer far more awareness about these things, and that's all to the good. But I'd like you to speak a little bit more about some of the background about the fight for free speech in Canada. And I think one aspect of that, Paul, that I'd like you to talk about was the way in which the establishment took real notice of the restrictions on free speech on the Internet when Maclean's magazine became involved in this, because the aux of a major media outlet in Canada was gored, so to speak, that this made people sit up and take notice who did not particularly care when the victim was Aaron Zundel or Mark Lemire.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think in both our countries there's been a shocking lack of support from the mainline media. If Aaron Zundel had gotten fair treatment early on, and if the press had alarmed people or sounded the alarm about denial of freedom of speech, and why that's bad regardless of what you thought about Sundell or did 6 million really die, things would have been a lot better. The media basically badly let us down. But anyway, the turnaround in the Internet case really came about three years ago when radical Muslims, several radical Muslims, took a leaf out of the activities of Canadian Jewish groups, and Maclean's magazine, which is in a sense Canada's Time magazine, published a chapter of Mark Stein's book, and Mark Stein was discussing the Islamification of Europe, that over the next 50 years, as he saw it, with high Muslim birth rates, large Muslim immigration, lack of assimilation, that there would be parts of Europe that would become essentially Muslim. There'd even be Sharia law. And he said this is a bad thing. Well, the Muslims filed three human rights complaints. One was the Canadian Human Rights Commission regarding Maclean being online. One was to the Ontario Human Rights Commission, one was to the British Columbia Human Rights Commission. The Ontario Human Rights Commission very reluctantly had to dismiss the complaint because they had no jurisdiction under Ontario law. But not without the tribunal chairman, who's a bitter feminist and socialist, saying, well, it was a highly insensitive, and she's sorry that she didn't have power, because if she did have power, she'd want to chastise Maclean. So they would talk about, a conviction without a hearing. British Columbia, I think, in British Columbia, they dismissed the charge. Well, But the real chase was all with the Canadian Human Rights Commission, because what was absolutely legal for Maclean's to publish in print might be, because truth is no defense, intent's no defense, problematic online, which is a bit of a contradiction. This suddenly got the press's attention, and the press finally used our material and went ballistic. Truth is no defense. How can this be? Hearings where every defendant's always convicted. Outrageous. Kangaroo hearings. Hey, just, we said that 10 years ago, but that's okay. And finally, paper after paper editorialized, get rid of Section 13. Columns, no columnists that I'm aware of in Canada supported Section 13. Right, left, and center, even left of center papers like the Toronto Star, were calling for Section 13 to be abolished. That entirely changed the landscape. We have led to believe that the lawyers from Maclean's couldn't believe the jurisprudence. When they actually looked at it, and the editors, the report of the editors, and I think essentially, now I'm giving you my interpretation. I think the lawyers simply said to them, gentlemen, you're screwed. Well, what he said is just his opinion. It doesn't matter. Well, what he said is based on fact. Doesn't matter. We didn't have any intention of creating hatred or contempt or just talking about the situation. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that a privileged group, in this case Muslims, might have been exposed. I'm probably not hatred, but if you believe, I mean, if you believe Mark Stein's arguments, you might have a lesser opinion of them because he suggests that the Islamicization of Europe would be a bad thing. Well, if it's a bad thing, that means Muslims are not a good thing, which means, well, I mean, so essentially you can't criticize them. And I think the lawyers told them, you're up the creek. And they couldn't believe this. Well, part of me says, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for you. We've been telling you this. We've been emailing over 1,000 journalists reports of tribunal after tribunal where poor, when I say poor little people, I mean people with no money, couldn't afford a lawyer, are getting just absolutely legally gang raped. And one that being, is the yawn of the Canadian media. They didn't care. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a tremendous reproach to the poor quality of Canadian journalism. They only began to care when, holy yumpin', it was they who were on the firing line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well put, Paul, because very often, if a principle is not upheld, in the case of people we don't care about, it can come back to hurt even those who don't think it's ever going to apply to them. In fact, I would go so far as to suggest that if the Mark Stein Maclean's case had not become the issue that it was, there would be far, far less effort now or likelihood that finally this law in Canada is going to be overturned so that the right of Canadians to express their opinion on the Internet will, in fact, be upheld.
I'm not a Buddhist, so I can't recommend people to just suffer. And out of your suffering eventually will come good. I'm not, but I must say that there are a lot of people whose lives were badly damaged by this type of legislation. People suffered a lot, but we have fought back. And in the end, I believe the evil of the people who are for censorship, particularly people like Richard Warman and other people, the professional censors at these commissions, has come back. They eventually went too far. They went too far with Maclean's, even though I think their political masters read them the Riot Act. Don't allow this complaint. Well, actually, they didn't allow it. But meanwhile, Maclean's had spent a bucket load of money. We do know how much another priest spent. There's a conservative magazine called Catholic Insight. The editor, that's a Father DeVock, he published an editorial explaining the church's view on homosexuality. A complaint was made. In the end, it was not accepted. He spent $20,000 in legal fees just working up his defense.
Well, thank you very much, Paul, and much of the credit for the victory that and the battle that's been fought so far, I think should be given to you, because you've been fighting this for a long time. Of course, there are many others who have been battling as well. But the final word is that there is no final word, and the battle continues. And this is an important one for the future of all of us, not only in Canada, but also in the United States and the entire Western world. I hope you'll join me for the next broadcast of the Mark Weber Report.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.